Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. 2020 will mark 75 years since the United States first occupied the Japanese island of Okinawa during the last months of World War II. Well, here we are 75 years later, and the United States is still there with 32 military bases. 50,000 American military members, contractors, and their families live on Okinawa, an island of just 1.5 million people. And the American presence permeates every aspect of life. A recurring theme throughout this history has been violence against women by members of the U.S. military. There are thousands of incidents on record. The most recent was the 2016 rape and murder of Rina Shimabukuro, a 20-year-old Okinawan woman, by Kenneth Franklin Shinzato, a Marine veteran who still worked on a U.S. base. He was sentenced to life in prison, but the incident fueled the fire of a long-standing campaign to get the U.S. military out of Okinawa. Well, today's guest, Akemi Johnson, traveled to Okinawa many times to chronicle its abusive relationship with the U.S. military. But the longer she stayed and the more people that she met, the more complicated the story became. Her new book is Night in the American Village, Women in the Shadow of the U.S. Military Bases in Okinawa. The book is a deep and fascinating look into an overseas community hosting the U.S. military, with an estimated 400 military bases in approximately 80 countries around the world. The book has lessons for similar cities and towns. She writes, quote, "The United States is the only country in the world to have this worldwide network of bases, and yet they remain largely outside the American consciousness. Americans unconnected to the military do not often think of these bases," end quote. Well, today we are joined by Akemi Johnson. She's a former Fulbright scholar in Okinawa and has written about the island for a number of publications, including The Nation. She's also contributed to NPR's All Things Considered and Code Switch. And Akemi joins us in studio. Hi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this is a fascinating book, and you spent just about 10 years on this. So
yes.
First of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
It's a lot of work to write a book, and especially when it involves this much travel. Can you talk a little bit about when you first started learning about military bases on Okinawa?
So I think Okinawa first entered my consciousness in a college course on the Pacific War. And what really shocked me and stayed with me were these stories of the Battle of Okinawa during World War II, when the American forces invaded Okinawa. And the Japanese military actually pressured or even forced many, many Okinawan civilians to take their own lives in these so-called group suicides, where whole families had to kill each other in this kind of improvised frenzy and, you know, just unimaginable horrors. And so that was really my first awareness of Okinawa. And that battle is the beginning of the U.S. military presence on the island.
And then why did you decide to go back to really immerse yourself in the culture? Because you spent a lot of time with women. You went out at night to kind of watch them interact with members of the military. What really sparked that?
The first time I traveled to Okinawa in college, the place instantly resonated with me personally. I am fourth generation Japanese American and biracial, half white American. And I had traveled first to mainland Japan and thinking that I would feel some kind of personal connection to the country. And I did, but, you know, not as much as I had imagined, I think. I think it's a common experience for many people. And, you know, in the U.S., I often identified myself as Japanese. I have a Japanese first name. But once I traveled to Japan, I found people there saw me as American. And I couldn't even pronounce my first name correctly so that people could understand it. So it was kind of this, you know, identity issues there. And so when I traveled to Okinawa, I found a much different place than the mainland. And it seemed to be somewhere that had more space for someone like me. And I kind of recognized something of myself in the landscape, in this mixture of cultures and the American influence, the Japanese influence, the indigenous Okinawan influences are all mixed together. And that was the beginning of my fascination, really, with this place and why I started going there and going back again and again.
Let's talk a little bit about the history of Okinawa. It's a former kingdom that's been ruled by Japan since at least the 1800s. And the history is really fascinating. Tell us just a little bit about what we need to know about that history and what you learned when you were doing your research.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, it was an independent kingdom, so it was totally separate from Japan until the late 1800s when Japan overthrew the king and annexed the islands as a prefecture. So it has its own history, culture, and languages, which unfortunately are dying out because after the annexation, Japan issued strict assimilation policies that pressured Okinawans to become Japanese and learn the language and lose their own language. In school, students had to wear like a wooden sign around their neck if they were caught speaking Okinawan language. And the only way they could get rid of that sign was to catch someone else speaking the language. And then they would pass off the sign to that other person. So it was like a sign of shame. So, you know, Okinawans did kind of quickly become, you know, so-called Japanese. But many people today really are trying to revive that indigenous culture and language and see themselves as Okinawan first.
And you talked a little bit about this, but the major battle that led the United States to occupy towards the end of World War II, you mentioned the mass suicides that were really pushed and encouraged by the Japanese military. More than 300,000 people died there. Can you tell us more about that battle that led to the U.S. occupation?
Yeah, so many people consider the Battle of Okinawa as a deliberate sacrifice that Japan made to delay U.S. invasion of the mainland, delay or discourage the invasion, so that they wanted to drag out this battle as long as possible and, you know, at the expense, really, of civilian lives. It was one of the bloodiest battles of the Pacific War, lasting about 3 months, really brutal ground fighting, heavy losses among American troops, Japanese troops, but really the highest loss of life was among Okinawan civilians. As much as a third of the population of the prefecture died in that battle.
And are there many reminders of that on the island? Like plaques or statues or museums, anything
yeah.
like that?
Yeah, I mean, one scene in my book, one service member tells me in this club, you know, he says, Okinawa is haunted. And this Okinawan woman with me says, yes, Okinawa is haunted. There are so many haunted places. And I think the battle really does hang over the whole island still. There's, there's one part of the island in the south where there are a lot of memorials. But I think, you know, even beyond the memorials, it's something that everyone knows about, and you know that although that generation of survivors is, we're losing them. I think it is, you know, on people's minds there.
And as you report, the island of Okinawa is long and skinny, about 7 by 70 miles. 1.5 million people live on the island, and that includes 50,000 American military members, contractors, and their families. And you write about the American bases in Japan became concentrated in Okinawa because the 1952 peace treaty restored only the mainland's sovereignty. So the U.S. military won continued rule of Okinawa, and over the next decade, bases closed on the mainland, but they multiplied in Okinawa, where the military enjoyed total control.
Right, right. So that's another part of Okinawa's history, is that the U.S. occupied Okinawa 20 years longer than mainland Japan. And really, that was the time when the U.S. could build up these bases in the islands, because Okinawans lacked rights at that time. They were not citizens of the U.S. or Japan. And so while they did resist this base buildup, they couldn't really stop it. And during that time, the U.S. took land by force, what the locals call by bulldozer and bayonet. So forcing people from their homes, bulldozing neighborhoods and building these bases.
In fact, they displaced thousands of people to construct these sprawling military facilities.
Yes.
How big is it? I mean, you've got a map in the book looking at the island, and then there are, in fact, you describe two maps, one that does have the bases for tourists who go to mm-hmm. Okinawa, and then another map that does have the bases. And in your book, we have the one with the bases. How big are we talking about? How huge are these bases?
Until recently, it was about almost 20% of the island. Some land was returned recently, so it's a little less than that now. But when you go there, you really do feel their presence, especially in the center of the island where they're concentrated. And one of the most striking things about them is that Okinawa is a small island, and so off base, it's really crowded, dense, these dense cities with a lot of concrete and no space. And then you look over to the base past these tall fences, and on base it's just, you know, wide green lawns stretching out and wide roads, so much space, very few buildings and people, and it's like night and day beyond the fence.
You write that the shorthand you use to describe Okinawa to Americans is the Hawaii of Japan, and this is because the chain of islands is far away geographically, culturally, historically, from the rest of the country. And as we talked about, the islands were an independent kingdom taken over in the 1800s. So can you talk more about that, the Hawaii of Japan? I think it's a good way to just really describe it.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, helps Americans maybe understand this place. Another aspect is that Okinawa is a subtropical island, so it's gorgeous. It has the aquamarine water and white sand beaches, and so it's also been kind of exotified as this tourist destination as well. So there's that part, and you know, people there are really struggling to you know, keep their culture and language in the face of all these changes.
And out of 1.5 million people, how are people doing there? I mean, what is the poverty rate like? Are there a lot of homeless people there?
So it is the poorest prefecture in Japan, but I think some service members may find that the standard of living feels higher than where they have come from in the U.S. Many service members actually choose to stay in Okinawa and build their lives there even after they leave the military.
And why is that?
I think they fall in love with the island for many reasons. It's, as I said, a gorgeous place, and maybe they meet someone, a local, and fall in love, get married, have kids.
The things you write about the bar scene is fascinating, which we'll get into in a minute. But I want to ask you, you talk a lot about misconceptions and how your ideas of Okinawa turned out not to be true. And I really appreciated the complexities because it's very easy to make assumptions about places we don't know based on our politics and our opinions. So what did you think it would be like? And what was one of the biggest misconceptions you encountered?
I think the stories from Okinawa, if we hear any stories at all, are often about the crimes, like the one you mentioned, and these stories of victimhood of Okinawan women, and then the anti-base protest that occurs as a result of that. And so I really went there expecting to meet people who are anti-Americans, anti-American military bases. And what I found was much more complicated and complex, and I found many more ambivalent feelings about the bases. And I also found that, you know, most Okinawans don't see themselves as victims of the U.S. military presence, and they are instead actively engaging with the U.S. military presence in some way.
And there are many different ways that they engage. Mm-hmm. Can you just give us a few examples?
Yeah, so they might be working on base. They might be working around the bases and relying on them in that way. And many people form relationships with U.S. service members, whether that's friendships or romantic relationships. And many are also fighting for the removal of the bases.
Right. There's a pretty strong activist community there, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
And a lot of women, especially, mm-hmm. are fighting to get the military out of Okinawa.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the biggest fights now is that the U.S. and Japan are building a new base on the island. And in a recent referendum, 70% of Okinawans said they do not want this base, but the U.S. and Japan are going ahead and building it. It's on this gorgeous bay with, you know, many endangered and endemic species. And, you know, it's going, the plan is to fill in this bay with sand and gravel and build a new base. And so every day there are Okinawans outside of the gates, the construction site, protesting, sitting in, trying to stop the construction, going out on kayaks onto the bay and trying to stop the construction.
It was interesting to learn that today Tokyo pays billions of dollars of the annual costs of U.S. military bases in Japan, to the point where the United States covers little more than troops' salaries. While most countries receive money from the U.S. to host bases, Japan and other, quote, affluent but once occupied nations with a tradition of bearing American burdens, as scholar Kent Calder told you, actually pay the United States. These nations include Germany and South Korea, with Japan consistently paying the most. What explains that?
Well, I think it's, you know, it goes back to World War II and this kind of special relationship between the U.S. and Japan, and that, you know, the peace constitution that came about at the end of the occupation of Japan, that says that, you know, Japan will not have a military, even though it really does today. But the idea is that it doesn't have a military, and so that it will receive protection under the U.S. military umbrella, and in return for that, host U.S. bases.
Today, we are speaking with Akemi Johnson about her book, Night in the American Village, Women in the Shadow of the U.S. Military Bases in Okinawa. And she's written a very interesting book looking at the overseas community hosting the United States military. It has been almost 75 years since the U.S. first occupied the Japanese island. 32 military bases are still there. 50,000 American military members, contractors, and their families live on the island of just 1.5 million people. So if you have any questions for today's guest, Akemi Johnson, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you've ever been to Okinawa, what was your experience like? If you are of Japanese descent, what impression do you have of the place? What stories have you heard over the years? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. So 32 military bases, 50,000 military members, contractors, and their families are on Okinawa. What are these bases currently used for?
So they're used for training, mostly. And so that's, you know, one argument that anti-base activists make is that, you know, this training could happen anywhere. And so, you know, does it really need to be in Okinawa? Do all of these bases need to be on this one small island?
And can you talk, I mean, training on all of these bases, that's a lot of bases, 32.
Yeah, definitely.
And also, what's the transparency like? I mean, are you able to actually talk to people who make decisions about how the bases are used, how much money is actually spent on all of these service members and these bases?
It is often hard to talk to military officials about these bases. And, you know, in my book, I wanted to focus on the locals' stories, because
right.
I think, you know, to me, that was the stories that I didn't know about.
Right. And just to think about all of these bases, you write, American bases provide jobs but also eat up land and spew soldiers, families, and American culture. They fill the air with jets, the roads with tanks, the ground with toxic waste. Can you talk more about that? Just how it feels to locals to have this presence in their backyard constantly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what I realize is that the military base profoundly affects people's lives in so many ways. And, you know, there's the issue of their own, you know, identities. I think a lot of people come to shape their identities in response to this base presence and maybe, you know, take on aspects of American culture in their own identities. But then there are issues also of, you know, personal safety. There's this one military base, Futenma Air Station, that's in the middle of a city that has the density of Chicago. And so there are these, you know, aircraft taking off and landing on this base every day and flying over this densely packed city. And there's definitely the risk of an accident happening. There have been a couple already. Luckily, nobody was killed, but people are kind of, you know, wondering when that might happen. And so you know, there's also toxic waste that's been left behind by these bases. So there are health issues as well.
And how is the government dealing with those health issues? Both governments. Mm-hmm.
So far, not. They aren't really dealing with it much at all.
Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Ka'ala, who is originally from Hawaii, calling from San Francisco. Hi, Ka'ala. Welcome to the show. Do we have...
I really appreciate the conversation. And I was hurt by when you said that Okinawa is the Hawaii of Japan, much like Hawaii is for the United States. And I don't know that you imply that it's just because it's a tourist destination, or were you also referring to the history of Hawaii and how we became part of the United States, much against the wishes of the Hawaiians at the time, and there's still some movement there for sovereignty? Is that the kind of thing you're really referring to, talking about Hawaii, or rather Okinawa is Japan for Hawaii for Japan, I should say?
Yeah, exactly. And it's definitely not a exact comparison, right? But because Hawaii used to be an independent kingdom as well that was, overthrown by the U.S. and made a state, right, with its own special history and culture and language. I think there are a lot of similarities between the two places.
Thank you, Ka'ala. Actually, you just reminded me, I've been wanting to do a show about what's happening in Hawaii and the various movements there. Thank you for calling. We were talking just about the toxic waste, the air that's filled with jets, the roads that are filled with tanks. The culture has also drastically changed because of these bases. You write that on one day, your friends and you bus to the American Village. It's a kind of a USA theme park erected near the beach where U.S. forces first landed in 1945. In a purple-lit club pulsing with hip-hop, you sipped cups of watery awamori, which you can tell us what that is. It's the island's distilled rice liquor, and danced alongside Okinawan women in camouflage hip-huggers and laughing Marines. So what is this American Village, and can anyone go there?
Yeah, so it's actually like a shopping center, but it symbolized to me a lot of the contradictions of Okinawa. It used to be base land, and actually it's near the point where Americans actually first landed on the island during the invasion of Okinawa. And today it's like a USA theme park shopping center, kind of. There's this, Statue of Liberty. You can buy old Life magazines there, eat really bad, like, steak with canned carrots and peas, and tourists go there, but also U.S. service members go there and hang out. And it's kind of the commercialization of the American military presence there. All over the island, I started noticing these kind of tributes to America, and often an America of the past, like of the occupation days. There's old cars like painted on buildings and benches and, 1950s style diners around the island. And that was really interesting to me because I knew that the occupation years were a very difficult time for Okinawans. And so I was really curious about why there also seemed to be this celebration of those years as well.
Do the young Okinawans know the history well? And what do they think about these contradictions?
So what I found is that the young Okinawans do not know the history because it's not taught in schools. Education is standardized in Japan and across the country. So students might learn a little bit about the Battle of Okinawa, but they don't learn about what's happened since then. So they don't learn about the occupation years, the movement to end the occupation, and really the genesis of these bases, how they were built on land taken from locals. And so young people were just born into this environment. The bases were always there, and many, as a result, don't question their presence.
We're going to take a quick break. Today we're speaking with Akemi Johnson about her new book, Night in the American Village, Women in the Shadows of the U.S. Military Bases in Okinawa. The United States has 32 military bases in Okinawa. 50,000 American military members, contractors, and their families live on the island of just 1.5 million people. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. Thank you.
This is Your Call, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 800-798-8255. You can also post a comment or question on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. 1A looks at last night's presidential candidates' debates as well as tonight's, one half hour from now at 11 o'clock on 1A here on 91.7 KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it is our media roundtable. And tomorrow, we are going to get an update on what is happening in Flint, Michigan. State prosecutors recently dropped all criminal charges against 8 government officials implicated in that scandal, saying that a more thorough investigation is needed. And so we'll get the latest. Later in the show, we will talk about the Supreme Court's refusal to approve the citizenship question on the 2020 census. And the decision to uphold partisan gerrymandering. These are huge decisions, and so we'll be talking about media coverage on tomorrow's show. Today we are joined by Akemi Johnson. She is the author of a new book, Night in the American Village, Women in the Shadow of the U.S. Military Bases in Okinawa. And this book explores many contradictions of the United States' presence on Okinawa. 50,000 American military members, contractors, and their families live there. It's an island of just 1.5 million people. There are 32 military bases there, and the American presence really permeates every aspect of life. If you have any questions or comments for Akemi, if you've been there, if you are have any kind of personal experience with military bases, or if you have any general questions, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. So we talked about this American Village, which is kind of a United States theme park. And then as you write that the bases are kind of like American bubbles, and they're insulated. They've got fast food restaurants like Subway and Pizza Hut. You talked about going to a wine tasting at one of the bases. Can you talk, what other experience did you have on the base? And can you talk about how hard or easy it is to actually access the base? It just depends on whether there's an event happening.
Yeah, I was able to to get on base quite a few times, so it can be difficult, but it also, you know, you need the right, if you have an escort to get you on base, you can. But I think for many locals, they cannot get on base, and so, but they can see the bases right through these wire fences, and so they loom large in their imagination. And so when locals do get a chance to cross over and enter that world, it does feel special, and you know, like this off-limits place that suddenly opens up, this whole new world that opens up, and it's almost as if you're, you know, traveling to the United States without having to leave the island.
What effect has this culture had on Okinawa? You write about trends of high divorce rates, drunk driving. Can you talk more about the legacies of the occupation and just bringing American culture to a place like Okinawa?
Yeah, one of the impacts that I noticed was American ideas of race and racism. I really saw that playing out around the bases. And, you know, the U.S. military used to be segregated, and I think a legacy of that continues today. When you go out to bars and clubs around the bases, it often feels like the military is still segregated, because you'll see service members of only one race often, or predominantly one race, at different clubs. And I kind of saw the local population forming ideas about race in response to that.
Yeah, this part of your book was really fascinating. So you have Latinos going to one club, blacks going to one club, and then whites going to a club. Can you talk specifically on that issue first, and then we'll talk about how the locals interact with those differences?
Yeah, that was something that I really noticed going on there, and it has a you know, a history on the island. There used to be really, in these base areas around the bases, there were different neighborhoods that were known as, this was the white neighborhood, this was the black neighborhood, and there were actually racial, you know, race-based gangs that formed and kind of battled each other in these neighborhoods, sometimes resulting in deaths. And the locals saw this playing out back in, you know, the 60s and 70s.
Hmm. Now, you learned a lot about this because you went to these bars. You spent a lot of time with locals, mainly women who live around the bases. And these are women who date and marry soldiers, who work on and around the bases, who have fathers or husbands in the military, who fight against the military. They're very connected to this. How did you meet them? And what were those relationships and conversations like?
Well, I had the chance to live on the island for a year as a Fulbright scholar, which was an incredible gift. And so I really had the time to live in this community and meet people and get to know people on a, you know, long-term basis. And there was a very interesting subculture that I found of women who state that they prefer to only date American men. And there's a word there on the island called Ame Jo that describes these women. And it's actually usually a derogatory term. But, you know, these women are pretty proud of their identities in this way. And they kind of change their whole identities around this desire to date American men. And it's often American men of only one race or another.
Mostly black men, you found.
Yes. Yeah. That was what people told me. That was the, you know, sense that service members had as well.
So this is really interesting. You write that you have a chapter about Eve, and you write, women like Eve who only wanted to date American men were common on the island to such an extent that they had formed a subculture. One quality was a style. Women transformed their appearances, their mannerisms, and their speech. And some of them actually watch Desperate Housewives to learn about how American women talk.
Yeah, how white people talk.
That's
what a woman told me.
With deep tans, gold jewelry, and slang, they tried to creep toward a foreign world. You write, when you lived in Okinawa, women who favored African-American men seemed the largest subset of this group by far.
Yes, yeah. And some of these women try to change their appearances as well. So they darken their skin. Maybe they try to speak in some version of American slang, and they, you know, will go to these clubs where they know black service members like to hang out, and, you know, all in pursuit of often a husband.
How has this changed Okinawans' views about race? I mean, given that they see that in many cases these military members go to clubs of their own race, and that so many of the young women want to date black men. How has that affected their perception of race?
Well, I realized at some point that, you know, maybe these women who have this desire to date men of only one race, that might have formed as a result of this self-segregation on the part of the military. Because if a woman wants to go out to a club where Americans are, right, she has to make a choice about which club to go to. And so then she, by extension, she's making a choice about which race that she's hoping to date. And, you know, in terms of this, these women who only want to date African-American men, I found that, you know, some of it is rooted in what seemed to me racial stereotypes and racism and this exotification of black men. But another part seemed to be a genuine feeling of connection between Okinawans and black men on the island, stemming from a shared experience of being discriminated against by the dominant population.
Hmm. And we briefly touched on this before, but as you say, the service members, especially those with a multiracial background, say they feel at home in Okinawa in a way that they never felt here in the United States.
Yeah.
So it kind of sounds like it goes both ways in some cases.
Yeah, definitely. As I mentioned, there are many service members who decide to never leave the island, and they do feel at home there.
How does that affect the older generation of Okinawans? So, for example, when a young woman dates a brown or black, a person of color, member of the military, how does the older generation respond to that?
There's definitely a lot of discrimination that I heard about, and women may face a lot more challenges than women who choose to date white Americans.
Hmm. And it also, you write about how some women feel empowered because there's the stereotype of the Japanese woman, which you also write about. And some of these women feel like they can really be who they are in these spaces.
Right, exactly. That was a surprising finding that, you know, the American bases actually create a space for many women to let their personalities really shine in a way that they couldn't in Okinawan and Japanese society, especially if they didn't feel like they fit into Okinawan or Japanese society, or they were more outspoken. They could, you know, express that part of themselves on base or in these American communities.
And that's what's so interesting, because when I first heard about your book, I thought that a lot of it was really going to focus on the rape and the murder, which you do address, and it's really important, and we'll spend some more time talking about that. But you put women's stories in the context of much larger issues, like education, like relationships, like empowerment, really, like feminism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and that, again, that was surprising to me, and it's a story that I really wanted to tell, because it's not a story of an island of victims, and it's not so black and white, and there is definitely a major issue of sexual violence that's taking place, but there are many other stories, and that women are actually, as you said, using the bases to empower themselves as well.
So we talked a little bit about Eve. I mean, every chapter is named after a woman, and their names have been changed for their privacy. We've got Arisa, Daisy, Mio, Kiki, Ali. Can you just tell us a couple? We don't have time to talk about all of them, obviously, but which ones really stand out for you? Which stories would you like to focus on?
One is Chie, and her mom actually is another woman, Sachiko. And Sachiko lived through the Battle of Okinawa. She was a high school student, and she was conscripted, like all high school students, into the Japanese military. And she served as a battlefield nurse during the Battle of Okinawa, and was working in these hospital caves and just really endured, you know, many horrors and survived that. And she, as a result, had, you know, a lifelong commitment for peace and demilitarizing the island and working to prevent something like that from never happening again. And so she passed on that legacy to her daughter, Chie, who is this high school English teacher, actually, who is just an amazing woman and dresses in all these rainbow outfits with flowers in her hair and is really this strong presence on the island. And she's an activist working to prevent the construction of this new military base.
Can you talk about the movement behind that and what's the update on it?
Yeah, so this has been going on really since 1996, when in the aftermath of a brutal rape of a 12-year-old girl in 1995 that led to a large protest against the bases, the U.S. and Japan agreed to close Futenma Air Base, which I mentioned is in the middle of this densely packed city, on the condition of building a new base in the island's north. And so since 1996, Okinawans have been protesting this base and waging a sit-in at the construction site, as I mentioned, and it's ongoing today. So the U.S. and Japan have started filling in this bay with sand and gravel, but Okinawans are still hoping to stop it.
Today, we are talking about the new book, Night in the American Village, Women in the Shadow of the U.S. Military Bases in Okinawa. And we're joined by Akemi Johnson, who traveled to Okinawa to chronicle its relationship with the United States. There are 32 military bases there. 50,000 American military members, contractors, and their families live on Okinawa, an island of just 1.5 million people. And if you have a personal story about Okinawa, if you were stationed there or know anyone who was stationed there, or if you are of Japanese descent, maybe you have families in Japan, what are your thoughts on all of these bases? As Akemi writes, the United States is the only country in the world to have this worldwide network of bases, and yet they remain largely outside the American consciousness. I mean, even those of us who know about the bases and talk about them, if we don't have connections with the military, we really don't know what happens on these bases. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from Ian in San Mateo. Hi, Ian. Welcome to the show.
So I've been to Okinawa. I went there actually to go there because it's one place people really don't talk about ever being able to visit, and I wanted to see what it was like. I found it very beautiful. Also like Japan, which I'm also familiar with. Beautiful beaches like you were talking about, with the sand and palm trees. It was actually something right out of a postcard. But one thing that really bothers me is that they talk about it's for training purposes to have these islands here. And the thing is that, you know, as far as I know, during World War II, it was a strategic spot. I called it a honeypot, not to be confused with anything else, meaning that it's a strategic spot for a military to want to be, for, you know, an army to want to be, to keep basically everybody at bay and in check during World War II. So when they say training, it really confuses me, because it just seems to me like it's they're never going to go, and I don't appreciate what they're doing to the villages and to the native people there. I think it's wrong, but considering that, you know, as far as I know, the truth of our history is it's a great place to be strategically for a military, and I just don't understand why they'd say training when the truth is they'll probably never go because of that, but they should.
All right, thank you, Ian. Akemi?
Yeah, well, if you look at a map, Okinawa is definitely a central place, and it's, you know, you can easily get to many places in that region from Okinawa. So it's long been very desired real estate to have, and, you know, that's why Japan wanted it, and I think that's why the U.S. likes having bases there. But I think many would say that, you know, question, do you need that many bases on this tiny island?
Right. And I've been repeating the number, 50,000 American military members, contractors, and their families. How many specific members of the military are there?
There's about 25,000 active duty service members there, and the majority of those are Marines. There are about 18,000 Marines on the island. So a lot of the anti-base activism is focused on the Marines specifically, and trying to get the Marines off the island.
We talked about Japan paying the U.S. billions of dollars to fund these bases. Do we know how much money is actually allocated for these bases? And we've done a lot of shows just about the high cost of war and bases, how things like clothing and laundry is always, if it's $5, the contractors charge $500. I mean, I'm throwing numbers out there. But is that what's also happening here? Do we know?
Yeah, I mean, I just anecdotally, I heard a lot about that, you know, just really high spending on base, that at the end of every fiscal year, people on base got rid of all their equipment and bought new equipment to drive up their budgets for the next year. And, you know, I went on base and there was really icy air conditioning, you know, which Japan pays for, and things like that. So I didn't do a lot of research into the numbers, but definitely living there, I felt the effects of that.
Mm-hmm. So contractors are making a lot of profits off of the bases in Okinawa.
It seems that way.
Right. Yeah. Well, thank you for the call, Ian. Let's go next to Richard in San Francisco. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I'm a former Marine. I staged into Vietnam, November 1967. We flew into Kadena. I was staged out of Camp Hansen. I don't even know if these places still exist.
They do.
A couple of memories. I remember that was a whole portion of the island that was blocked off because of the ordnance left over from World War II. Back then, that area had not been cleared. My other memory is in driving to Camp Hansen, we would drive by these houses, and they all had little figures in their roof. It was like they were keeping away the evil spirits or something like that, but it was very memorable for me. I dated a woman here in San Francisco that was from Okinawa, and what I can tell you is that socially they are very, very conservative, and that Japanese consider them second-class citizens. Those are my comments. God bless you both.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you. And I think that was, you know, part of what interests me about Okinawa is that I think there are so many Americans like you who have had these experiences in Okinawa over the decades and have really strong memories of the place. And yet it didn't seem to be part of our national consciousness. And so that was interesting to me.
Right. Have you met many vets like Richard who were stationed in Okinawa? Have you talked to them about your project and your book?
Yeah, I have. As I said, there are quite a few still there who I met. And right. then I think, and since the book has come out, many have talked to me as well.
And what do they say? What stands out for you?
I think, you know, they share memories like that and that have really stayed with them. And I think a lot do today, you know, recognize the local people's efforts to, you know, at least close some of these spaces and respect that.
Mm. Well, we have an email from Andrew who says, Japan has been effectively a one-party state ruled by the right-wing Liberal Democratic Party for decades. Recently, a relatively leftist party achieved power by campaigning on a platform of kicking out the United States. Obama refused, leading to the return of the right wing. One of those aspects is refusing to educate its youth about the atrocities committed by the fascist sector during and before World War II.
Yes, and that's part of, you know, the movement in Okinawa, too, I think, is to remember the Battle of Okinawa correctly. And those group suicides that I mentioned are, there's been a battle whether, you know, to have those in the history books or not. And they've been included and then taken out and then included. So definitely remembering correctly the Battle of Okinawa is on, you know, people are fighting for that.
There are many times in the book where we hear either American or Japanese authorities excusing sexual violence by men. One person in the book points to Japanese soldiers who kidnapped women and turned them into sex slaves in the Philippines during World War II. We've done shows about the so-called comfort stations that were set up following the war, and they employed poor women so that United States troops didn't take out their aggressions on the rest of the population. In the 70s, the local government didn't want to ban prostitution because they were afraid that soldiers would instead resort to rape. And there's this acceptance that this is just how men are, and stemming from that, a suggestion that militarism and patriarchal violent behavior are intertwined. And the phrase that you used is militarized masculinity. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, so there's one, you know, there's an idea that in order for soldiers to be soldiers and be able to fight in battle, that they need their masculinity reinforced by feminine figures. And so that women are needed around these bases to play that role. And that's the thinking behind this.
And I wanted to talk about the signs that you saw on posts that said, rape.
Yeah, no rape, no base, no tears.
Yes, thank you. So can you just talk about now that in some cases people are being prosecuted for rape and sexual violence, how has that changed the way that people talk about it and view it?
Well, during the occupation, U.S. service men often did not face any consequences for their actions. And so from what I researched, the problem of sexual violence was really out of control and very, very pervasive, you know, to the point where villages, if they saw American men approaching, they would ring a bell and all the women in the village would hide. And today there are, you know, people do face more consequences. But as I found, much of the sexual violence that occurs goes unreported. And that's a problem in Japan, you know, throughout the country. As little as 4% of rapes are reported to police. And actually, some service members in Okinawa have admitted that knowing this fact is one contributor to them committing rape because they feel like they are going to get away with it.
Right. And were you able to have any conversations with the service members about that, or just has your opinion changed just given the fact that you were able to watch closely the interactions between service members and the women in these bars, for example?
Well, I think, of course, you know, most service members are not committing sexual violence and are really respectful of the sensitivity of the situation, too. I did have an interesting conversation with some Okinawan female college students about this, who talked actually a lot about victim blaming, and they had kind of internalized these ideas that, well, if a rape happens, maybe the woman was not wearing the right thing. Maybe why was she out so late at night, you know, and they had friends who were in the military and had committed rape, and they felt bad that they were in jail now. And so, you know, that was interesting to hear that perspective.
We have about a minute and a half left. Towards the end of the book, you start to tie together the idea that the bases have been there for so long and people are so connected to it that it would be a shock to the culture if they shut down for some people. But other people still say they need to shut down. So what was your takeaway after, you know, experiencing firsthand the complexities of all of this?
Well, I think the most recent referendum where 70% of Okinawans voted to say they do not want this new base really shows that, you know, the military presence needs to at least be reduced in Okinawa. But at the same time, I think there will be something lost with the closure of the bases as well. And I just wanted to show that.
What do people say should take its place to ensure that people don't lose their jobs, for example?
A lot of people talking about tourism, mm-hmm. and now today, tourists from China, there are many, many in Okinawa, and people would like to build up that industry.
And how is that changing things on Okinawa? Or is it too early to tell?
Yeah, I think it's ongoing.
Yeah. Well, Akemi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having
me. Thank you for writing this interesting book. If you are in the area, Akemi Johnson will be speaking about her book at Book Passage in Corte Madera tomorrow at 7, and then at East Wind Books in Berkeley at 3 o'clock on Saturday. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Akemi Johnson is the author of Night in the American Village, Women in the Shadow of the U.S. Military Bases in Okinawa. There are 32 bases there. 50,000 American military members, contractors, and their families live on Okinawa, an island of 1.5 million people. And you can find more information about Akemi Johnson's book and her work at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will revisit the Flint, Michigan water crisis. State prosecutors recently dropped all criminal charges against 8 government officials implicated in the scandal, saying a more thorough investigation is needed. We will get the latest. And then later in the show, we will discuss today's Supreme Court rulings. They refused to approve the citizenship question on the 2020 census, and they also decided to uphold partisan gerrymandering. That is on tomorrow's Your Call. If you have a guest idea, a show idea, or feedback for us, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. You can find our past shows and podcast the show at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Andrew Steltzer for producing today's show, and thanks to Kevin Vance, who answered today's phones. He's also our studio engineer. Thank you, Kevin, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.